On this episode of Skeptico.
I feel like when I'm reading the book, you're talking about a deep evolution, a spiritual evolution that I get. I just don't know that we can really connect that with the dorky neo-Darwinistic bullshit that we've been fed that we just know isn't really true at some fundamental level. I mean, it's kind of been proven to be, at the very least, extremely incomplete, and at the worst, just not really very true.
My approach is, look, there does seem to be the fact of biological evolution, whatever the mechanisms, however we come to understand that, and it's a very powerful idea. Then 100 years ago, something amazing happened with Big Bang Theory, when we went, look, it's not just life, it's not just biology which is evolved, it's the whole universe has evolved over 13.8 billion years. So this period where we could argue about the biological mechanisms is only the tail end anyway. I mean, clearly evolution can't be about genetics only, because there was no genetics when there was the evolution of basic gases. There was nothing, you know. So the evolutionary process is much bigger than any biological evolutionary process.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Karras, and on this episode, an interview that I think is just perfect fit for what we do on Skeptico. Tim Freak is back. It's been a couple years since he's been on, but he's written a book called Soul Story that attempts to kind of resolve this science and spirituality conflict that we talk about so much and we all seem to be right in the middle of. I think the interview is quite self-explanatory, so no need for a long introduction. Let's get right to my very interesting talk with the very interesting Tim Freak. Today we welcome Tim Freak back to Skeptico to talk about his new book, Soul Story, Evolution and the Purpose of Life. For any of you who may not be familiar with Tim's excellent work, multiple bestsellers, his work as a presenter, and he has these really cool looking conferences. Well, if you don't know Tim, then you're in for a real treat. I'll just leave it at that. Tim, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining me on Skeptico to talk about this very cool new book of yours.
Thank you for having me back. It's a conversation I've been looking forward to, because I know it's going to be inquiring and address some proper issues.
Okay. You know, first off, I have to tell you, I'm used to getting electronic copies of books, but you kind of insisted, hey, I want to send you the physical copy, and I can see why. I mean, this is really kind of a cool thing. It's kind of a medium is the message book. You have to experience it because you've tried to, and I think very successfully, done some different things with the physical structure of the book that is part of the message. Is that kind of your intent?
It is, absolutely. I wanted to explore a lot of very big ideas very quickly in a way that could, because I thought the whole thing stands or falls as a complete narrative. So I wanted to move quickly, but I wanted people to be able to take in the ideas without a lot of padding. And so I looked at how I could lay it out in a completely novel way, like you said. If I say to listeners, there's no full stops and there's no capital letters, it will sound like it's going to be chaotic. But actually, because of the way it's laid out, it's kind of minimalist and clean. And the ideas, I hope, are like little droplets. They kind of go in, you can contemplate them and move on to the next one. And so far, the response has been like yours, Alex. People have really loved it. So I'm encouraged.
It works. No, it does work. It's a little bit, you're like, well, then it just kind of does. You can kind of suck it up faster. It's very, very nicely done. And, cool. As anyone who knows your work, but especially this particular book, Soul Story, it's a real fit for exactly the kind of stuff that we talk about on Skeptico. This idea, the way you start the book, let's give people the basic premise of this ambiguity that you tap into, and I think so many people feel an experience between, living in a scientific, technology-driven world and yet being drawn to the magical and the mystical part of life. I mean, frame that up, the basic premise.
Well, I think, I became a philosopher when I was very young because I wanted to understand my life. And here I am much older and I'm still trying to do the same thing. And I want to understand my life as I actually experience it. And the way I experience life is very ambiguous. On the one hand, I clearly live in a reality which I need to understand in a cause and effect way. You know, I drop something, it falls, and there's a kind of almost a brutal causality to the world, and there's a level of in which it feels pretty chaotic and meaningless. On the one hand, but on the other hand, I also experience life to be intensely magical, full of what people often call synchronicities, but those moments when meaning breaks out. When I've explored the awakened state, which has been my preoccupation for most of my life, there's a profound sense that this journey which we're on is incredibly important. It has deep purpose. And somehow I need to come up with a way of understanding the whole scope of reality, which can incorporate both of those. And that's, you know, for a long time, I think like many people, I've just lived with the ambiguity and tried to ignore it. But as a philosopher over the last 10, 20 years, I just can't do that. I've needed to go, look, is there a way which we can understand this, which honors both those experiences, which incorporates my understanding and my experience of life in the way that science addresses it, but also my experience of life in the way that spirituality addresses it.
I get that in a sense. I get that a lot of people are coming at it from that way. Tap into that need to understand things scientifically and why you were drawn to that. What do you struggle with scientifically? Why do we have to bring science along, I guess?
Well, I don't think we need to if you're happy not to, and a lot of people aren't. But I myself find that I find the scientific understanding so powerful. It is able to explain so much of its own level, and not finally, not in a way that's complete, in ways that I think need questioning and revising. But nevertheless, that I can sit here in Glastonbury in the UK and talk to you on the other side of the world is because of this incredible understanding which the scientific method and science has given us. And I can't help but be impressed by that, and which is why it's become the dominant worldview, especially amongst the intellectual mainstream anyway, not I don't think generally, but in the intellectual mainstream, certainly in the UK, it's the dominant view. And on the one hand, you know, it can, I mean, I love watching all these documentaries about the wonders of the universe and all the rest of it, and it is very wonderful. But there's a lot of small print. And the small print that comes with the mainstream view of science is, oh, and by the way, you live in a universe which is accidental. Your life has no meaning. You're here for a few minutes, long enough to go, what the hell? And you're gone. And it can't address any of these other experiences. That's the issue. So within its own terms, it feels like we need it to have a complete description of the reality we're in. And in particular, and this is a thing which the book focuses in on, over the last 100 years especially, it has come up with this incredible evolutionary narrative of the evolution, the emergence of the whole universe. And that is, you know, whether the details are right or wrong, you know, we'll go on debating that for hundreds of years, I'm sure. But the overall narrative is incredibly powerful. And what strikes me from that narrative is it can help us unite the experiences we have of soul or spirituality with the experiences which are much more basic, the way matter works, the way that biology works, which science has been preoccupied with. And that there is a way in which we can see them as coming together rather than being in conflict. But both need to change for that to happen.
So this idea of evolution, and also I think you used the word emergence there, but those two ideas are threaded throughout this book, and I think they're the vehicle by which you see this merging together, this resolving of the ambiguity. And I'd like to dive into that a little bit. I'm not totally sold, I guess, that one evolution packs enough punch to really do that. I mean, I feel like when I'm reading the book, you're talking about a deep evolution, a spiritual evolution that I get. I just don't know that we can really connect that with the dorky neo-Darwinistic bullshit that we've been fed that we just know isn't really true at some fundamental level. I mean, it's kind of been proven to be it, at the very least, extremely incomplete, and at the worst, just not really very true.
I think for me, the whole issue about biological evolution and neo-Darwinism is irrelevant, actually, in that what I'm trying to do, it doesn't make much difference whether it's right or wrong, because I don't come up that close. As you'll know, really, there's not very many scientific ideas in the book. It's not a book about science. It's really taking the scientific narrative in its broadest philosophical sense. Now, how the mechanism works for biological evolution, that's a whole issue. You could write books and books on that, but I'm not the person to do it. What my approach is, look, there does seem to be the fact of biological evolution, whatever the mechanisms, however we come to understand that. And I think the philosophy which I articulate could be used retrospectively to actually question a lot of the assumptions of neo-Darwinism. But I'm not doing that right here. What I'm doing here, well, my play really to those coming from a scientific point of view, because I want to address both. I want to go, hey, people from a scientific point of view, see it this way. Hey, people from a spiritual point of view, see it this way. So from the scientific point of view, the basic way that I'm coming in is to say, look, with Darwin and Wallace, we developed this idea of biological evolution. Now, we need to keep re-understanding that, but this idea took hold, and it's a very powerful idea. Then 100 years ago, something amazing happened with Big Bang Theory, when we went, look, it's not just life, it's not just biology which is evolved, it's the whole universe has evolved over 13.8 billion years. So this period where we could argue about the biological mechanisms is only the tail end anyway. I mean, clearly evolution can't be about genetics only, because there was no genetics when there was the evolution of basic gases. There was nothing, you know. So the evolutionary process is much bigger than any biological evolutionary process. But the key thing for me is, look, we see now that we can see these two phases of evolution which have distinct mechanisms and which are, you know, have evolved from each other. One is the development of matter, which has seen, you know, all the elemental table develop and the galaxies and all of that. And then we've seen this whole different thing, which is the evolution of life, which is a more emergent phase. It's emerged from that more primitive phase of evolution. The thing which I'm suggesting is that we now, having gone back and gone, oh, there was a phase of evolution before biological evolution, now we need to go, oh, yeah, and there's another phase of evolution after biological evolution. And that's the evolution of soul. And that's what spirituality has been studying all of this time. Now, I feel like if you let me run, I need to say something about the word soul, because to make sense of what I mean by that. What I mean is... The word soul, I like it because it's warm, but we can use many names, actually. The ancient word was psyche, or psyche, and we use that word now. So what I mean by soul, what the word originally meant, is it's referring to the fact that right now, you and I and everyone listening is experiencing two utterly different dimensions of experience. On the one hand, we're experiencing sensation of being a body, an animal in the world. And on the other hand, we're experiencing a completely different level of experience, which you can call the imagination or the mind or the psyche or the soul. And in my view, these are all really different words for the same thing, which come from different linguistic roots. What it's referring to is an absolute indisputable reality. And one way I love to get that, because as I love the obvious, is to say, as I speak now, what you're hearing, Alex, and what the listeners are hearing is me make funny noises. That's what's actually happening in the world of sensation. And yet, what you're actually experiencing is meaning. But that's all in soul. That's all in psyche. There's no meaning in the funny noises. That's a different level of reality which we are experiencing. And it's a reality which is not made of matter in our experience. If you look at it right now, it doesn't exist in space. It has no location. And it's made of mind stuff. It's made of memories and images and thoughts and imagination. And my experience as an explorer of soul is that if you go off into it, if you explore it with meditation or ayahuasca or whatever you want to explore it with, it's huge out there. There's all sorts of things to discover in that other dimension. So what I'm postulating is I think anyone who, even the most mainstream scientist, would agree that the latest thing to arrive in the evolutionary process is psyche, is soul. The problem is that for mainstream science, they go, yeah, but it's just a side effect of a piece of meat. But that's like saying the fact that you and I are alive is a side effect of a load of chemicals, the carbon. But it's much more than that. If you took a pile of chemicals that make up my body, it would be very different to meeting my body, even though the constituents would be the same. It's an emergent thing. So what I'm suggesting, in essence, is we need to understand the emergence, the evolutionary emergence of soul, the place where we are functioning now, the place where we're having this conversation, as the emergence of a whole new level of reality. And that level of reality has come through first matter, then life, biology, and now this a more emergent level, soul. And it's in that more emergent level that we can make sense of experiences like magic, meaning, and immortality, all the things which spirituality is concerned with.
It's a very interesting idea. I mean, you're extremely brave to stick your neck out there and try and do something completely different like this, and to really try and integrate, you know, this whole science thing with the religion thing, because you also have this background of being kind of someone who's been characterized as being very critical of religion, and you're trying to kind of bring that camp back together. But I do want to drill into this, a couple of these things of the evolution, the emergence thing. Because like what you're saying about evolution, it's not just the mechanism in what we can write books for. I mean, the counter to what you're saying is that science has got the evolution thing fundamentally wrong. And that, yeah, there is this adaptation that we can see in moths on a dark tree, but that's really mischaracterizing what's really going on, because we're all in this field of consciousness. And the thing that really shook me up is when I learned about the scientific evidence for self-directed neuroplasticity, which is a really fancy way of saying that you can think about thinking and change the physical structure of your brain. Well, given that we can do that, then the fundamental idea behind evolution is backwards, is that our consciousness is driving our evolution.
It is now, Alex. What about before there was human consciousness? What about going to the dinosaurs again? Because they're such a great example. If we're just in a field of consciousness and there is no evolution, and it's all, you know, it's like, it's very hard to make sense of those things. And then you need to make sense of them in a new way. And I'm not really sure we can.
But Tim, we can't appeal to time to kind of rescue us there. Take something that's really tricky for science, like entanglement, right?
Mm-hmm.
Entanglement pushes us to the limits of science because we can no longer measure. We can no longer observe. That science has obsoleted itself and saying, hey, you know what? I came to the conclusion. The conclusion is, we don't know what we're doing. We can't really measure. We can't really observe. Well, when did entanglement happen? That goes all the way back to the Big Bang, right? If you see these two particles and we say, oh, this is how they become entangled. But they were entangled all the way back to the Big Bang. So if entanglement is some representation of consciousness at some level, then consciousness existed all the way back, or at least that has to be on the table as another working hypothesis, is that
it doesn't work for me. It doesn't. I mean, I've played with those ideas for 20 years, 30 years, and I've ended up having to say it doesn't work for me. It's very attractive. I've come very close to saying those sort of things in many of my books. But when I've really looked at it, for me, it just doesn't work. You know, consciousness as the background just feels like the wrong word, because consciousness comes and goes, for one thing. You know, what happens when, you know, if you hit my head, I go unconscious and the world disappears. So it's like in a field of consciousness. I mean, I've used these words. I'm sympathetic to the view because I've been very close to it. And it's essentially the spiritual view. But my feeling is that neither that one, the extreme which goes, look, the ground is the subjective consciousness, is as wrong as the ground which of the mainstream, what I call objectivist science view, which goes, no, the ground is the objective. Only the object really exists. The subject is an illusion. And then spirituality comes across in its various idealistic forms and goes, oh, no, consciousness is what really exists. And everything's just a form in consciousness. My feeling is, as a paralogical thinker, someone who wants to bring the opposites together, is that we need to conceive of both subjectivity and objectivity as arising through the evolutionary process, so that everything in existence has a subjective and an objective nature. And the way that you can characterize that is that right from the beginning, which is where I think your entanglement stuff might come in, is that every individual thing, and I'd like to explore the nature of time with you if we can in a minute, because I don't see things as things, I see them as processes. But every individual process stroke thing is individuated. It's a separate part of an integral whole. And as such, everything else is viewing it in some way, and it is viewing everything else in some way, whether it's a basic chemical just registering the electrochemical environment. It's discriminating its environment in some way. And by the time you get life, plant life, and then sensuality and so forth, it's discriminating its environment in ever more evolutionary ways. So one of the things which for me, and we need to turn around, is that science sees, because it's objectivist only, it sees evolution as the evolution of a lot of objects, which eventually, for no apparent reason, create a subject as a byproduct, as an epiphenomena. What I'm suggesting is more closer to panpsychism, but different. Not that consciousness is all the way through, but subjectivity is all the way through. So that subjectively, we've seen the evolution of discrimination from electrochemical discrimination through to sensual discrimination, through to what we're experiencing, which is conceptual discrimination. And as that happens, the subjectivity evolves, leading to this level of psyche or soul that we're experiencing right now. So the ground is neither of those. The ground, I call it spirit, because that's the ancient word for it. Hegel used the same word. You can use any word you like. That there's a primal potentiality from which everything is becoming realized. And it's realizing itself in ever more emergent ways, both objectively, with ever more complex objective forms, and subjectively, being able to read its environment in ever more complex and conscious ways. So consciousness has arisen out of that evolving subjectivity. Now, if you can indulge me, once you've reached the point of soul, then I think this is going, look, this level of soul is not some, it's not an epiphenomena, it's not a passive byproduct, it's an engaged process. So just as the level of life, that the fact that my body is alive is changing the chemicals within it, so the fact that their soul, which is where we tell stories, where we have narratives, that is affecting the material and the biological worlds, which is why we get the phenomena you talk about, neuroplasticity, why we get bigger than that, why we get magic, why we get intentionality leading to the unfolding of story in our lives in meaningful ways. That we can start to see the way in which this level of soul is actually interacting with the sensual world, but not in a total way. This is the key for what I'm saying. Objectivists are going, it's just the object, all the rest does nothing. You get a lot of spirituality which goes, it's just consciousness, you can override everything. Everything that happens to you is because of your unconscious intentions. Whereas it seems to me that the whole of the evolutionary process means that the universe exists on a lot of levels at once, from the very, very basic material right the way through to this level of soul. And they're all interacting all of the time. And to miss out any of them is to misunderstand our situation.
On a spiritual level, that's very deep and profound. And also, there's a line through just about every wisdom tradition that would come to agree with you. And I think that's a great compliment to your work, that you found a different path, and yet it does seem to echo and resonate with other paths out there. I do feel the need, I guess, to keep coming back to some of these scientific words that we're using.
Before you do that, Alex, can I just say one little thing about what you've just said? Because it feels important. It feels like what I said earlier was the thing that I'm doing is I'm asking both science and spirituality to change. So for science, I'm asking them to swallow a big thing. I'm saying, look, there's another phase of evolution, which is the evolution of soul. And it's completely unlike everything else that science studies. For one thing, you can't measure it in the same way. It's not made of matter. It's a whole different ballgame, but it's linked to it. But with spirituality, I'm saying something which is also pretty confrontational for many spiritual traditions, because in spirituality, you get consciousness comes first, the soul is eternal, you know, the place you go after you die has been there forever, there's a great purpose, it's all come from God in the first place, and this is his dream, or this is its dream, or it's this is a mistake it's made, or all those myths. What I'm saying to spirituality is no, let's contemplate the idea that everything is the potentiality of spirit coming into form, is the potentiality of experience emerging. So the place we go when we die, which I write about a lot, in that is itself evolving. The imagination, the place of images, which we can inhabit without the body, we're inhabiting it right now, has arisen. The soul has arisen, has emerged. Everything, meaning, has emerged. Immortality has emerged. So that it's asking to let go of this idea that that's already eternal and pre-existent, and seeing everything in an evolutionary current, which enables us then to explain why the world is actually also pretty unpleasant, as well as being magical. It's pretty full of meaningless, unpleasant horrors, because it's evolving from that. It's evolving from a place where there is no meaning, or not meaning in that way, into a place where there really is. And that this is what I'm trying to say. That's why it's confrontational to both sides.
Well, great. I don't mind a little confrontational, especially when it's well thought out and super cool presented like it is in your book. I mean, you're taking a stand. Three problems, though. One is evolution and the way you're using evolution, and you're using it from a scientific, basically something we inherited from Darwin, and it doesn't work. And it doesn't work because it doesn't factor in what we know about evolution, and that is that consciousness is driving evolution. And we can prove that, like I said, with self-directed neuroplasticity. If we don't factor that in, we're never going to get science on board, because science has looked at it.
Just stop a second, Alex, and let's just look at that one idea before you move on to the others. Because look, what I'm saying to you is, yes, you're right. First of all, what I'm presenting with biological evolution, it doesn't have to be to do with Darwin at all. You know, it just started with Darwin.
Yeah, take Darwin out of it, but we have a lot of baggage to drag along. Just like when we start talking about spirituality and religion, there's a lot of baggage that we do have to unpack. So, I mean, I think when we start talking about an evolutionary process, we have to say what that is.
Take the neuroplasticity as a good example. See, it seems to me that what we need to explain is, how can consciousness be affecting evolution now, human consciousness, whereas clearly it wasn't affecting it in the same way when there was dinosaurs or even before there was any life whatsoever?
That second part is an assumption. So what I'm saying is, if you take the first part, which science is not on board with, I mean, Tim and I are talking and we're on board with that, but we're going to have to drag science. That's going to be a huge leap over the chasm for science to get to that point and say, gee, I guess they're wrong about evolution, and that evolution doesn't explain the mind-brain problem. They are not on board with that. I talk to these folks all the time. I mean,
of course they're not. And one of the big confrontational things in the philosophy of emergent spirituality and soul story is that it returns to something which is a complete, it's really not approved of these days, which is what would be dismissed as a duality of body and soul. Because right. Even in spiritual circles, it's become progressive, it seems, to think that body and soul or body and mind are the same thing. And certainly for science, they are the same thing. Now, spirituality has always claimed they're not the same thing, because that's what allows the survival of the soul after death. And one of the great tragedies of the currents which evolved in the 70s and 80s of dismissing what used to be called derisively Cartesian dualism, in fact, because it was seen as preventing oneness, was that got lost, and it seemed progressive, but actually it created a real philosophical problem. What I'm suggesting is that they are separate things, but they've arisen, they have an emergent relationship, so they're linked. That's as we experience them to be, for sure, but that they are also different. And my basic method is to constantly return, at least in part, to immediate experience and go just have a look. You can see they're different.
I agree with you. First, let's tackle that word emergence, because it keeps coming up again and again and again.
Sure.
And that's another one, like evolution, that I'd say, you know, it's kind of a pet peeve term of mine, because I love the way that you're using it in this deep, soulful way that demands we look for the greater meaning in it. I do have to pause for a second and say, that's not where science is when they talk about emergence. And when we hear science folks talk about emergent, they use it like science fairy dust that they can sprinkle on stuff and say, oh, there's an emergent property to consciousness. But what they really mean is we see sand dunes form and we call that emergent because we can model it in a computer and we know what sand is and we know what moisture in the air is and we know what wind is and we can model it in our computer and look, it emerges. And you know what? That's what must be happening with consciousness. No, we have not come anywhere close to proving that that's what's happening with consciousness. We don't know what's necessary or sufficient to cause consciousness. We don't know when it begins or ends. So we don't know any of that. So if there's a deep, soulful explanation for or soulful use of the term emergence in your work, which I think there is, great. But we have to separate that from what science thinks emergence is.
Well, I think the key, that's why I call it objectivist science, which is the mainstream. You know, it used to be materialism, but materialism has fallen to bits philosophically, but it's objectivist or physicalist. It basically thinks the object is real, not the subject. And that to me, you know, I'm not in the business of defending that in the slightest. I think it's utterly wrong. And I think it's taken us down a red herring. What it's done is, it's been a red herring. What it's done is been very good at studying objects. But it's absolutely useless once it tries to look at subjects because it doesn't think they really exist. It explains the nature of the soul by going, it's not there. It's an illusion. It's a phantasm. Well, clearly that's not true. And what's happening is you're dismissing the most important thing. So all I'm doing is coming along, one of the things I'm doing is coming along and going, look, we're having this conversation in soul, in psyche. We're having this whole conversation with concepts which aren't made of matter in a different realm. Now, somehow that is linked to biology, and somehow that's linked to matter. So, but clearly the current explanation, which is being seen philosophically as absolutely true, I think, by an awful lot of people in our culture, is absolutely wrong. It's just not good enough. So I'm in complete agreement with you. And what I'm trying to do is create a new way. What I'm not trying to shore up mainstream science with mainstream spirituality at all. I'm trying to suggest a new science with a new spirituality, but one which keeps all the really valuable stuff that we found, because we've got a lot of very valuable stuff in both. We just need a different philosophy so we understand what we know in a different context. We can keep what we know, but we need it in a different context because the context is not working for either, I don't think.
Tim, you have a lot of creative and interesting ideas about the after-death aspect of our existence, of consciousness, if you will. So lay those out and tell us where you came up with some of that, because I think some folks will take it and will just be drawn to it, and other folks will be, wait a minute, on what authority is he saying this stuff of what's happening after death?
Yeah, absolutely. And just to be clear, I'm not saying this on any authority at all in any direction. You know, I say this as a explorer of life who has some insights and is often confused and is doing his best to create the best narrative and the most expansive narrative and to also experience life in the deepest way that I can and share it with others. That's all
it
is.
Absolutely. Great.
So in that spirit, I'm very concerned with death. I've worked with people who are dying. A lot of people I know have died. I've nurtured a lot of people through death, including a lot of people close to me. And it always feels to me something really important is happening. I've had experiences of people after death. I've met an awful lot of people who've had near-death experiences. And I can't just dismiss all of that. So for me, as an individual, the question is not, do we survive death? It's how the hell can I explain the fact that we do? And now I know a lot of people aren't in that situation, and I respect them completely. But for me, it's more like that. How can I understand this? How can this be right? And the way that I framed it and is to talk about the evolution of this other level. You know, when I talked earlier about we exist as subjects and objects, one of the things which I think is important is that one of the things that physics has come around to is that nothing exists in the three-dimensional solid way that we think it does. And one of the ways that we can understand it, therefore, is everything is a type of information. It's pretty vague, but it's enough, which means that we can see information as existing on the physical, biological, and soul level. And information on a soul level, which is where you're understanding the meaning of these words, is different to information on the biological or physical levels. So somehow we can understand, well, let me try this analogy. It's a bit very quick way of trying to say what I'm exploring, but as a simple analogy, maybe it helps. For me, when I wrote my book, it looked like all that information was just on my computer. And if I dropped my computer or spilt coffee on it, I'd lose my book. It would die. But actually, all the information that made up my book was actually going straight to the cloud, which meant that if my computer died, the information was still all there on a completely different level of information and could be accessed in a different way. In a kind of comparable way, as a simple analogy, something like that is what I'm suggesting, is that the information has arisen on a level which is non-material, which is like the cloud, compared to just being locally contained within my body, which is where it's linking in some way with the brain. A whole load of questions about what that means. But leave those aside for a moment. So then what I'm suggesting is that with the arising of soul, with that other dimension, the dimension of images, has arisen a realm which we can go into, at least for a while, after death. Which is why I think if you listen to people's near-death experiences, they sound like dreams. Why? Because they are. But they're not unreal. They're real dreams. They're real on that level. They're real on actually a more emergent level, which is a level in which we can experience as images. Images that we've gained from our sensual experience take on a life of their own in soul. Again, we experience that all the time. Now, when we sleep, we can just go deeper into it. So what I'm suggesting is that heaven, if you like, in inverted commas, has itself evolved. And one of the things which I noticed when I wrote a book on people's ideas about the afterlife years and years ago was you can see this kind of evolution of it, whereby it starts as something quite, you know, shades, something nebulous like the Greeks, which suggests that this, what I call the imaginos, the dimension of images, is only just coming into form, and then it starts becoming a reflection of an idealized life, the drinking halls of Valhalla or the happy hunting grounds, that kind of image. And then you start getting with the big religions coming in, and then it's populated by thousands of Buddhas or saints and choirs. And now you get these huge vistas, incredible experiences that people have in near-death experiences, which are multicultural now, of course, and full of, you know, vast cities and all sorts. So what I'm suggesting is, hey, this other realm is itself evolving. And what we're doing now is moving between these realms. That's what spirituality has been saying for a long time. It's just that it somehow saw that other realm as pre-existent because it had no idea about evolution. Now we understand evolution. Here's an interesting thing. It itself has evolved.
You know, Tim, one of the things that keeps gnawing at me is, how do you factor in time in this? You know, I've spoken with a couple of folks who have mediumistic talents who've told me, first thing you tell me is, you know, our whole conception of time is way off. And this idea of this life, next life, past life is just blown away. It's not the way it is. This is what they're telling me. We are constantly being reincarnated multiply into multiple lives that we're living in. This idea of how we experience it, which is very linear, is not at all what's really going on. I mean, how does that factor in?
I don't relate to that at all. I mean, I've heard it said, of course, I live in Glastonbury, which is a center for all sorts of spiritual ideas. I respect people who have their experience and whatever, but also I'm looking.
But this is basic science. Science would not like this linear time thing at all. They say that
science
just
is the same. I mean, it is very popular in both science and spirituality to say that time is an illusion, and I think both are wrong. I myself have said it many times. You'll probably find it in my books. But having meditated on it long and hard, right now, I'm here wanting to say, I think that's wrong. And here's why. Because when I look at the moment, when I look at reality as it actually presents itself to me, the thing I can't dispute because it's now, I see time. I see a flow of changing experiences. So rather than it being an illusion, it feels like we should start with the premise that reality is time. We just need to re-understand what time is. So that rather than seeing things as things, some sort of slice called the moment, we see that everything is a processing time. Everything is what I call a time stream, me, you, the desk in front of me, the computer, everything, the plants I'm looking out the window, everything actually is a process. And that time is fundamental. And then I want to make a big suggestion about the nature of time, which is I want to say we've got the wrong analogy. We say that time passes. Most of the time we don't even notice it's an analogy, but it is. What I want to suggest is a better analogy, which is that time accumulates. So there's more past now than there was when we started this conversation. There's more past now than when we both, you invited me, when we both grew up, when we both learned to speak. We've more time now than when the Big Bang happened, when human beings first evolved, all of that. And I want to suggest that the past hasn't gone anywhere, that the past is implicit in the present, that implicit in this moment is everything that's ever happened before. And if it wasn't, it wouldn't be this moment. Implicit is you and me first talking. Implicit is, you know, us learning language, like I said. Implicit is everything that you have been and everything that I've been and everything that's happened is implicit in this moment, which enables us to do history and which enables us to even have this conversation. Everything is requires that. So that what's come into form has come into form forever. Of course, we can re-understand it, put it in new context, see it in a new light. But this conversation has happened now, and it will have always happened. I will have said that. What I meant to by that can be questioned, blah, 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 but it has happened. So that what this moment is the meeting of everything that has happened and everything that could happen, the past and the possible, everything which is fixed and everything which is unfixed. This idea is a very ancient one. Actually, it goes back to Pythagoras, who talked about the meeting of the limited and the limitless, the past and the possible. And that what's happening is that time is expanding. So information is accumulating, which is defined. And because the past is constantly expanding, there's a tendency towards evolution and greater emergence. So that more and more emergent possibilities are arising through the evolutionary process as the past accumulates. So that the universe, far from time being an illusion, the universe is made of the past. That's what it's made of. That's what you and I are made of. Right now, everything I've been is meeting everything that you've been. That's what we are.
Okay, Tim, what about what parapsychology has to say about that? Because they've looked at that, right? And in the book Soul Story, you do touch on psychic abilities a little bit, and you kind of just a tiny bit dabble into that. Parapsychology has tried to study this in the lab because so many of us experience, like you said very early on, these experiences of these little time shifts that we have, these synchronicities, these looking ahead and looking behind in this timeline that we're in. And lo and behold, when they put it in the lab, they say, wow, you know, there is this precognitive effect that's going on. There is this presentiment effect that our biology is even aware of a shift in this time frame. Doesn't that butt up against what you're saying?
No, I don't think so. And again, it's because we need to understand the nature of soul, what I call narrativity. You know, I've made up a lot of words, as you will know, having read the book, and I've done that because there's nothing. The concept doesn't have a word. So what I wanted is to say, look, what defines this level of soul that we're experiencing? Well, it's concepts, it's ideas, it's memories, but above all, it's story. It's a narrative. It's where, you know, I am above all a story. I'm Tim's journey through life. And when I meet other people, I go, how's your story? And they say, I'm like this. How's your story? Because that's how we experience ourselves. Now, the traditional wisdom certainly in science is, oh, well, that's a kind of a mental byproduct. It's nothing. Whereas what I'm saying is, no, evolution has led to the evolution of story, which is its own level. A bit like in a computer game, you can have the ones and zeros, which are pretty fascinating. And then you've got the computer system, which is like the biological level. And that's interesting. But really, it's all about getting to the story. And that's what it's been about, is playing on the level of story. And that's where we're playing right now. Playing on the level of story. So what I'm saying is that level of story is not a passive thing. It's interacting all the time. So just as on the level of biology or physics, I can predict the future. I'm not always right, but I can predict the future, which is how we can make this internet work. Because, you know, people have been able to predict that if you do this and this and this with physical matter, it behaves in these ways. And in the same way, we have the facility to see, oh, this is where the story's going. And that, but it doesn't mean it's definitely fixed. It just means that's the way the story is going, which is why sometimes it's not right. But I think we can start to explore how all of those experiences, the fact that we connect non-locally, the fact that, you know, I just met an old friend of mine while I was writing the book, and I'd been contacted by a mutual old friend, and they just knew. I don't know how they knew. They knew their name. They just went, oh, you've been contacted by someone. All of that strange, mysterious stuff, which we all experience. Well, not all of us, maybe, but I certainly do, and I'm sure you do. That gives us a vehicle by we can start going, ah, this is how this can fit into this other world. This is how they can fit together as different levels of emergence in one spectrum of experience, all of which is operating at the same time and interacting, and not any one level of which is absolute. All is relative to each other.
Okay, we spent a good deal of time talking about kind of the science side of this ambiguity that you're trying to kind of wrestle and merge and find resolution for. The other side, of course, is the spirituality side. You say spirituality very early on in the book. You say spirituality is outdated, pre-rational, and that this religious mindset is something that we cannot tolerate, most of us, in this scientific world that we live in. At the same time, when it's all said and done, can we step back and say, hey, wait a minute, maybe these wisdom traditions, looking at the whole, have been pretty darn close to the big answer, the same answer that you come to, that it is all about love. It's about connection. It's about this deep truth that we share with one another. Is religion, are we being a little bit too harsh? Are you being a little bit too harsh on religion in terms of it coming to the right answer?
Possibly. I mean, one's always more critical of the things you're involved in personally, probably, and I'm much more ready to criticize spirituality because I know it so well, and I feel I'm criticizing it from the inside and with affection. You know, for me, it's like what I want to see is a form of spirituality which is all-encompassing. So I want that, you know, nothing is more important to me than the deep center of awakening and oneness and above all love. That's the most important thing. But I also want it to be able to deal with questions in a rational rather than pre-rational way. Now, if people don't, that's fine. That's up to them. But I need to. And I want to see if it's possible. And I believe it is. I believe that we don't have to dismiss rationality in order to devote ourselves to love, or dismiss rationality in order to believe in life after death. I think that we can have a robust intellectual defense of these things which we intuitively know. Now,
I hear you saying that, but do you think rationally oriented people who are looking for that view of life, that worldview, are going to find comfort in especially the last two thirds or maybe three quarters of the book? I love that stuff. I love the stuff you're talking about, and it resonates to me. But I kept thinking, I go, who is the rational minded kind of logical person who's going to?
The truth is, Alex, I'm probably writing for a very small group of people who are like me. That's the honest truth. Now, I'd like to think that I could reach all of these extremes of people who are in a religious mindset, and I'd love to think that I could reach hard-nosed materialists, and a few I probably will. But overall, really, I'm writing for people like me, which is people who want to keep their mind as well as their heart, but won't sacrifice their heart for the mind. They want both, because they are both. And so for me, and part of that is then to make the questions. It's like the whole where the book ends up is really a theology. Where the book ends up is about God, seeing divinity in a new way. So you couldn't get farther away from the place where objectivists want to start. And I'm aware of that. And I'm aware that, you know, I'm going to be losing more and more with each chapter potentially. But but again, what I'm articulating really is primarily for myself and people like me. It's like I can't, that's what I have to speak to. I have to speak to my experience. But also it means I want to be critical of the places that I've been myself. Like, for instance, you mentioned it, it's a good example. If you have an intuition towards God, for want of a better word, I'm using it, a supreme being or something, a being of love, which I do. I have had it since a kid. It's hugely powerful experience of relating to something bigger and just so good. It's very hard to square that with the traditional problem that philosophers call the problem of evil, which is how come the world, if God's at the beginning of time and he's created this or it's created this, how come it's so horrible? And it's really, really, when you see the suffering, when you actually see the suffering, it's pretty hard to get your head around that. I don't think you can. And also what I call the problem of absurdity, which you mentioned with the dinosaurs. Okay, if God's at the beginning and he wants this to, us to be souls exploring our devotional relationship with him or it, what the hell's 160 million years of dinosaurs about? That's just crazy. It's absurd. So for me, again, it's been like, well, is there a way which I can understand this experience I have of relating to something greater than me that is all good, which doesn't fall into those problems? And for me, the place where the whole book leads is the idea that there's another level of emergence happening, which is the emergence of spirits in a transcendent form. And that God, to put it very blandly in a way that might sound a bit silly, but hopefully it isn't, which is to say, rather than putting God at the beginning, put God's at the end. That God is not where things start, but that transcendent spirit is where things are going. That the deepest, most emergent levels of reality are coming last. It didn't start with soul. It ended with soul. It started with hydrogen. And it came a long way from hydrogen to this experience we're having now of intelligence and soul and love. And that the deepest things are coming last because they need the buildup of all that past to carry them. And the supreme, the transcendent being, that big consciousness, which everything is being held in, isn't at the beginning, it's at the end. It's arising now. And as we awake, so it is coming into form. And that's a very different way of seeing what spirituality is from an evolutionary current rather than for something which can't cope with that.
Well, it is a very novel and is intellectually invigorating idea. The whole book is like that. I mean, it's challenging. It's wonderful to work through. It's like I said, it's beautifully presented, and you're to be congratulated, Tim. I mean, Soul Story, Evolution and the Purpose of Life. Our guest has been Tim Freake. Tim, what have we left out here that people would need to know about the book? And tell for a minute about the other things that you do and how you engage with people in other ways.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess the bit we've covered a lot, which I knew we would, because I knew you'd ask some great questions and bring up some real challenging issues, which has been a real pleasure to engage with, I have to say. I think the thing which has been missed out, which kind of touched in a bit in the end, which is that for me, my life is actually centered around the idea of awakening, is around the experience of awakening, what I call being deep awake. That's what most of my books are about. This is a philosophical underpinning of that. And one of the ideas that I'm exploring is that the cutting edge, the leading edge of evolution right now is spiritual awakening, is spirit waking up to itself, the great potentiality from which everything has come, is arising consciously through us when we enter these deep states and bringing the transcendent spirit, God, if you will, if that's not too difficult a word, is arising through that. So most of what I do is help people experience the deep awake state. So I have this huge privilege of traveling around the world wherever I'm invited and taking people directly into the deep awake state so that you can actually feel that love. You know, when we were talking earlier and you were saying, that the great message in all these spiritual traditions, love, oneness. And the key with that is it's not just an idea, it's a direct experience. And when you have it, you just know something so deep it's before words. So what I do at my deep awakenings is I share that experience, and I feel very privileged because, wherever I go, it feels like, just about everyone can experience it very quickly. I think it's part of our collective evolution that's now possible, but sure as it happens without any doubt whatsoever. So my if people are interested in both the philosophy and the awakening, there's loads of stuff which they can have on my website where there's meditations I lead, there's videos and audios, and they can see about the events that I'm running and sign up for the newsletter so that they can hear if I'm coming to their country or their area. I'm certainly going to be coming to the States twice this year, but they're not announced yet. And they would hear those, and take part in inquiry. And so for me, it's about developing a new approach to awakening for the 21st century, which isn't guru-based, isn't based on some absolute authority, isn't me telling people how it is, but which is a community of life explorers looking for the deepest experience and the deepest understanding of what life is, so that we can make the most of this amazing journey we're on.
Excellent. That's a good, interesting context to put it in. You're walking the walk and kind of your experiential thing. And in this book, you attempt to kind of talk the talk. So that's cool. Tim, it's been great having you on. And I do appreciate you so much coming on and subjecting yourself to some hard questioning. But I like where the kind of conversation can go and everything that you bring to it. So again, congratulations and thanks again for joining me.
It's been a real delight, Alex. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks again to Tim Freake for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess the question I tee up from this interview is, do you think it's going to work? Do you think Tim's approach of trying to get science and spirituality to play nicely together through the common bond of evolution and emergence, do you think that has a chance? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website or the Skeptico Forum. SKEPTIKO.com is how you spell Skeptico. So find us there. All these shows are free. You can find over 350 of them there on the website. And then connect. Tell us what you think. Tell me what you think. Tell other listeners what you think. Love to hear from you. So I have a number of interesting shows coming up. I know I kind of always say that, but I just am excited about some of the interviews that I'm about to publish or am in the process of producing. So I guess that's a good thing. Anyways, that's going to do it for now. Until next time, take care and bye for now.